And we begin. Okay, so tonight, we are one night, we are 24 hours away from the holiday of Shavuot. And it has been the reality during the entire, you know, Corona stay-at-home, whatever, sheltering in place, staying at home, quarantining, whatever the thing is. In the New York, New Jersey area, we're not going to have the benefit of coming together as a community and being in a synagogue and learning with friends and with family, you know, whether it be all-night learning or all the different typical Shavuot experiences that we've been grown to love. So the challenge here is I want to sort of like, and the title of this class called Shavuos, Home Alone. And how to, what is a good strategy? What's a good strategy? So the first thing to do when dealing with a situation is, number one, is honestly acknowledge the disappointment. We have to admit that we are, and even angry. So the question is, how do you deal with the disappointment? Because, you know, the first thing is to admit, because a person might say, look, I'm upset that I'm not getting what I want. I want to have a Shavuot where I'm eating meals at different people's homes, and I'm coming together with family, and I might be going to MG with 300 of my closest buddies, or my local shul with hundreds of people, and enjoying a variety of fine foods at everybody's house, versus I have to do everything in my house, and I'll be by myself, or maybe with a roommate, if I'm lucky. So how do you deal with that? How do you deal with the disappointment and anger, and how do you work through that? Just in general, this is a good life skill of when things are just not working out. What is a good way to address that? Any suggestions?
Can we repeat the question one more time?
The question is, we had the same experience on the Seder. People were upset that they weren't with their family or with the people they wanted to be with. They're disappointed and even angry. So the question is, what is the methodology to deal with that?
You have to, this is Jade, you have to just push through and as hard as it may be, and as hard as your evil inclination, your Yetzirah wants to take over, because I know I struggle with that. You know, it's been hard for me to focus on learning lately.
Right.
And I've been struggling with that for, I don't know, like the last month or so. And in my head, I'll be like, I don't want to learn. And then I just have to dial into the class. I have to push myself. And, you know, and once I'm doing it, you know, I'm fine. But I have to, you know, just push.
All right. So
for that little voice in your head and try to have gratitude for what you do have.
Ah, okay. So first of all, so Jay said a lot of good things. So number one is that, first of all, you have to be honest with yourself. Since I'm not, in other words, part of the joy, and I'm speaking for myself as well, that part of the fun of learning at MG was literally going to the 10th and 11th floor of MJE with everybody together, because it's like a multifarious experience. There's the schmoozing, having a bite to eat, catching up with old friends. This learning and the camaraderie, which even though that Zoom is great, but it doesn't have that same communal feel. You know what I'm saying? You know, it has a lack, especially if you're working in you know, by day, and you're in front of a Zoom screen like for hours a day, like you're zoomed out. You know what I'm saying? So you're like, don't want to do any more Zoom. So the first thing to do is to be able to get into a attitude for Shavuos is to develop that attitude of gratitude. And I'm going to help you all, and I'm speaking to myself as well. Number one, if you and your family and your extended family are physically well, you have to feel that blessing of gratitude. Nearly 100,000 Americans have perished. Thousands more have been sick with COVID. And if your family's been spared for whatever reason, you got to feel gratitude about that. Second thing, if you are either A, have a job or able to support yourself through the situation, You got to feel gratitude to that. There are 30 million Americans who are unemployed and having a very rough time. So you got to just grab onto that and feel good about that. Number two is that likely, I'm not a prophet, I'm only a teacher, this will likely be our last Shavuot alone. You know what I mean? I think that, you know, ultimately, hopefully, we won't, even if there's a second wave, I'm not sure if it'll be a third wave. I don't know. But it's a reasonable assumption. So this is not an eternal problem. This is likely to be a temporary problem. And as just to echo back what Jade said, by pushing through, you're basically saying, I'm not going to make myself a victim. And just because I can't have the Shavuos of my dreams, I'm not going to go for, I'm just going to sit on the couch and just veg out for 2 days and, you know, veg out and overeat. Okay? So that's strategy number one. Acknowledge the disappointment. You recognize you may be angry about it, but count your blessings. This is a temporary problem, not an eternal problem. And don't be victimized by the circumstance. Number two, very important. We're 24 hours to go. Failure to plan is plan to fail. You may have heard me say that once or twice. Which is that if you want to have good meals, either A, you got to be doing some shopping. You got to be doing some cooking. You got to do some buying. Similarly, if you want to have some good learning, you got to prepare. And that's what we're going to do tonight. We're going to do some, I have a strategy. We're going to go do that together. Not to mention Rabbi Wilds shared on our WhatsApp as well as it's online, ou.org/Sinai has lots of great packets of shiurim to download and to listen to and work through over the chag. So you got to prepare. And you got to say, and then that gets to point number three. Do not make the perfect the enemy of the good. Which means that learning for 1 hour after dinner with a nice cup of coffee and an hour or so in the morning or in the afternoon or whatever it is on both days is also a win. You can't say, well, if I'm not going to do the all-night learn-a-thon plus the getting up for a Vesikin davening sunset with MG Chazan of choice on the rooftop, seeing the sun slowly rise over the Manhattan horizon, I don't want anything. Okay? So that might be your sense of the ideal, and that's a fantastic Shavuot, and many have spent it, hundreds have enjoyed that. So be realistic. What can you do? Give permission to yourself that, hey, I may not be, I don't have a whole encouraging chevra, but I can do something, and we'll figure out what that something is. Now, I'm going to provide some things tonight, but I think you can also provide other things as well. Make sure you have learning options, i.e. printed out, or if we have books available, with a variety of topics, because quite frankly, you do not know what mood you're going to be in. Okay, if you're going to have like one safer McGee and like you're not in the mood for that, then you're going to have it's going to be a dud. So you want to have a variety of articles. I'm going to give you some material tonight. Download it from the internet. There's a humongous amount of material available. So whatever you're in the mood for, you know, treat yourself. You want to do a little chumash, you can do a little chumash. You want to do Megillas Ruas, you can do Megillas Ruas. You want to do halacha, you can do some halacha. You want to do some Pirkei Avot, you can do some Pirkei Avot. Whatever you want. It's all about the learning, okay? Pick the stuff you like, you know, a variety. I encourage you getting a variety. You still have 24 hours to download and print off the internet, okay? So, again, if you're going to wait to 5 seconds and like try to do it then, that's not going to work out. So I recommend doing that. Now, we're going to do together. I'm not going to quite give a shiur, but I'm not going to just assign you something. We're going to do like this. We're going to go through the material. We're going to raise questions. Okay? I'm going to sort of like, you know, like in cooking, you have par boiling or par cooking. In other words, you sort of prepare the dish a little bit, and it allows you at the actually right before serving it to complete the cooking. So I'm going to sort of like prepare the material somewhat with you, raise some of the questions, but I'm not going to answer them. And then you will be able to think about them and work on them on Shavuot. And then next Wednesday night at 8 o'clock, we will go over the questions and share what you guys have thought about. Okay, so it's a little bit a combination platter. You know what I'm saying? So we'll do some material together. We're going to get into it in a second. We're going to do Megillat Rut. Last night on the Parsha class, I did the first chapter. Not doing that again. I'm going to go to the second chapter. Makes sense. So, and this will raise some questions. Make sure you guys know them, get a handle of the material, sort of like get you a warm-up, a running start. I have some materials. I sent it to you in advance, of course. You have it. You can just print that out. There's some good stuff there. I put down some commentaries, etc. There's a link to also Safaria where you can access more free English commentaries, and we'll go. So that's the game plan. So before I go start, any questions, comments, or suggestions about how to ensure that you'll have the best home alone Shavuot as you can? Any other idea? That's what I thought about. Anybody got any additional ideas?
I think you should also prepare food that you want to eat and enjoy, and it helps make you feel like you're part of it.
10,000%, Anna. Yeah, and not only food. Don't forget the wine.
Yes.
Because there's a mitzvah of Simchas Yontif, enjoying the holiday, which of course is a couple of things is food that you enjoy, and for men principally it's meat and wine, but women like wine also. I've noticed. And
meat and wine?
Say it again?
You said meat and wine?
Yeah, meat and wine for the day meal.
I was going to say, because like, how's it going to work with dairy?
So, that's a good question. So, the Ashkenazic tradition was to have, you could have dairy at the night, so two night meals have dairy. And then by day, you could have dairy and then have a little bit of dairy and then go into meat. The custom of the dairy, if you go on the internet and browse the custom of the dairy, it's a rather recent innovation. In fact, when the Yemenite Jews came to Israel in the 1950s, they saw these Ashkenaz Jews eating dairy, and they're saying, "What are you guys doing?" They did like they never saw that. So that's just a so. But I personally made that effort. I ordered not one but two cheesecakes from our local baker here in West Hempstead, and I'll be doing a curbside pickup tomorrow at 10 a.m. You know, with a little raspberry top and marble variety. That's what I went for.
I like the marble.
I also got a parve one going in there as well. Parve cheesecake for the lactose intolerant slash also vegan slash, you know.
The meat eaters.
Right. The meat eaters. We're having two dairy and two meat meals. That's happened at the Rosenthal residence. Rosenthal Rancheros. Okay, so, all right. So that's... Excellent suggestion, Anna. Thank you very much. Okay, so let's get into it. I'm going to do a share screen. I'm going to catch up everybody. Let's go here. Boom. All right, so this is topic one. So just to catch everybody up or refresh everybody's recollection, we're dealing with the second chapter of Megillat Rut. So in the first chapter, you had Naomi and her husband Elimelech and their two sons Mahlon and Chilion leave Beit Lechem because of a famine, and they move to Moab. And then in rather seemingly fast the progression, her husband died, then her two sons Mahlon and Chilion marry two Moabite women, famously Ruth and Orpah. The two sons die, and then you have the dramatic scene of No, Naomi hears that the famine is over in Beit Lechem, and she's heading on back, and her two daughter-in-laws, Orpah and Ruth, walk with her, and then she says, "Why are you going? Go back home. I got nothing for you. I got no more sons. And even if I would have children, are you going to wait 20 years till they grow up? Not happening." Orpah recognizes that she's right. She kisses her mother-in-law goodbye, and Ruth says the famous line, "Wherever you go, I will go. your people are my people, your God is my God, wherever you lodge, I will lodge, wherever you're buried, I'll be buried. And she basically, as an act sort of conversion, follows Ruth. Chapter 2 picks it up when they've already moved back to Beit Lechem. People are shocked at seeing Naomi because she was clearly an aristocrat, and now her family is devastated because she doesn't have anybody. And she says, "Don't call me Naomi," which means sweetness. She said, "Call me Mara," call me bitterness. And we get to chapter 2. So let's have somebody read. Anna Bavakasha, start us off chapter 2.
Sure. "Now Naomi had a kinsman on her husband's side, a man of substance in the family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, 'I would like to go to the fields and glean among the ears of grain behind someone who may show me kindness.' 'Yes, daughter, go,' she replied, and off she went. She came and gleaned in a field behind the reapers, and as luck would have it, it was the piece of land belonging to Boaz, who was of Elimelech's family."
Okay, so it's interesting. Now, they don't seemingly have any manner of support. Their husband and all their husbands are dead, and they're moved back into their old house. And then Ruth comes up with the bright idea of, hey, maybe I should get some food here. So the question that I'm raised, and there could be other questions, is why was Naomi passive in dealing with her food insecurity? It was only after when Ruth mentioned it did she bring it up. So that's my question number one to you guys. Again, I'm not giving any answers. And number two is, why is Ruth active and diligent in her food gathering? You'll see through the rest of the chapter, she basically does gleaning and gathering the leftover foods, they call the shicha and the peya, which is when they harvest the grain in Israel. You're not allowed, one or two strands of, of wheat or barley fall to the ground, the poor, it's left on the ground and the poor can pick it up. So behind the reapers were poor people who would gather that, as well as they could not cut the corners of the field, and the poor would reap and harvest that grain as well. So she basically worked through the barley season in chapter 2 and the wheat season, and basically supports her and her mother-in-law. Now, here's question number three, we're taking it a little bit more closer to home, is how does this relate to our economic downturn? Are most people passive like Naomi or active like Ruth? You know what I'm saying? In other words, when people get confronted with job loss and dealing with the various challenges that an economic downturn provide, do they become motivated and activated like Ruth, or do they remain sort of like sitting on the couch like Naomi? And then, give examples of either passive or active reactions to the pandemic's economic challenge. So there's sort of a universal element to that. Any other questions on this little section? There are more questions, but I just picked three off the top. Share it for everybody.
Why does the text introduce Boaz before Ruth offers to get the food and then references saying, oh, she went to Boaz's field?
That's good. So it's sort of like the narrator introduces, like sort of like the foreshadowing. And right. Naomi had a relative on her husband's side, a rich man of her family, Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. Right, so it's sort of like the narrator sort of like foreshadowing. But your question is still strong. Why does it do like that? Why doesn't it just say, why do they tell she shows up at that field and then talk about the connection at that point?
But also it mentions, or it says twice, that Boaz is of the family of Elimelech.
Good. And that's another one. Why is that so critical? All right, we got it already. Also, you can ask another question, if her family is wealthy and she's in her house basically destitute, why aren't they helping her? Why is it only we're going to see that, Ruth comes to the place, comes to Boaz's field by chance, or seemingly by chance, And then they start to, you know, help her in that way. Why isn't there? Why aren't they offering help up front? You know what I'm saying? In other words, which is a general question, is Boaz a great character? You know, ambivalent character? A bad character? Let's continue. All right, so let's have, all right, Stephanie Bavakashuk, can you read a little further? You're on mute.
Starting with presently, yeah?
Yep.
Okay. Presently, Boaz arrived from Bethlehem. He greeted the reapers, "The Lord be with you," and they responded, "The Lord bless you." Boaz said to the servant who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose girl is that?" The servant in charge of the reapers replied, "She is a Moabite girl who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab."
So let's pause right there. What is very jarring to our ear?
Well, the use of the word girl. She's probably like a woman at this point.
Right. No, she was already married and she's already widowed from her husband. Right. Right. So I don't know if I have to see what the Hebrew was. I don't see what this is the guy's translation. Let's.
It seems like they're very like, you know, like when guys are in a bar and like they're like, "Who's that chick over there?" Like,
yes.
That's
what it right. Sounds. Right. It sounds a little. Yeah. It does sound like that. Yeah. So that's a good question. And also, but how are they referring to her?
They say Moabite girl, but then they repeat it, saying that she came back from the country of Moab. So I guess why do you have to include it twice?
Right, and also, first of all, there's a general point, there's a prohibition, which we learned on a Parsha class not that long ago, you're not allowed to afflict the convert. So if a person is a convert, if Ruth is a convert, either there's a debate that did she convert before the marriage, or did she convert, you know, seemingly this, you know, prior, why do they keep on calling her a Moabite woman, you know, from, you know, the Moabite? She already converted, and that's it. You know, so that's something I'm laying that question out.
But did she already convert at that point?
So there's Rashi seems to say that, you know, in the previous chapter, she says, you know, we learned the, some of the principles of conversion by her famous declaration to Naomi. You know what I'm saying? So either that she converted by her affirming her connection. I mean, because there's no mention of a conversion before she, because you know at the end of the story she marries Boaz. So I assume, and he's clearly a dignitary, he's not going to just marry a non-Jewish woman if he's a Jewish dignitary. In fact, the Medrash calls, he's actually Ivtsan, one of the Shoftim, one of the judges. And you see openly in the text later on by chapter 4, he's clearly one of the distinguished men. He's not going to just openly marry a non-Jewish woman. So we have to assume at one point she converted, either before she married, Chilion, Machlon or Chilion, I forgot which one, or prior to, or showing up at some point. But it is weird. She keeps on being called the Moabite girl, you know, the Moabite girl. No, I just think, let me just see if that's...
She doesn't see herself like she says, like, "Why are you so nice to me when I'm a foreigner?"
Right.
So she's not yet seeing herself as she still sees herself maybe as not yet a convert or like still an outsider.
Right. So just okay. So that's so correct. That's not a contradiction because she could feel that she's not really, she doesn't feel 100% welcome yet.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
But just to answer Stephanie's point, I'm looking at the Hebrew. Just to look at the Hebrew here. I'm just going to put it here. He says, Lemiha Nara Hazot. Nara does not have that bar. It just means, who is that young woman? This translates, whose damsel is this? All right, so, okay, whatever. We'll leave that alone. All right, keep on.
Okay. No, wait, I'm waiting. Okay.
There's a prohibition against being with Moabites. They're our enemy.
Okay, so there's David, excellent. That's another good question. So David is bringing up the general, the Torah says in Devarim, you're not allowed to marry, in other words, if a Moabite converts, you can't marry them. So, but what was determined by the Sanhedrin, according to the Talmud, is it's Moabi, velo Moabiyah. But if a Moabite woman converts, she can be married. She can marry any Jew. So that's a distinction. So that's a very good point. But that's sort of like a meta textual point, because that, because this story seems to go in contradiction to the prohibition in Deuteronomy. But excellent question, David. All right, let's keep on going. Go ahead, Stephanie.
She said, "Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the reapers. She has been on her feet ever since she came this morning. She has rested but little in the hut. Boaz said to Ruth, 'Listen to me, daughter. Don't go to glean in another field. Don't go elsewhere, but stay here close to my girls. Keep your eyes on the fields. They are reaping, and follow them. I have ordered the men not to molest you.'"
That's not
the Hebrew. I know, it's not like the direct, it's not the real translation.
Right. No, not to bother you, not to hassle you. The word molest in our culture has a dark meaning. Here means not to, in other words, you're free to gather, and, you know, you're 100% welcome here in every way.
"And when you are thirsty, go to the jars and drink some of the water that the men have drawn." She prostrated herself with her face to the ground and said to him, "Why are you so kind as to single me out when I am a foreigner?" Boaz said in reply, "I have been told of all that you did for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother and the land of your birth and came to a people you had not known before. May the Lord reward your deeds. May you have a full recompense from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have sought refuge."
All right, so that, it seems to, by the way, that is a direct reference to conversion. In other words, it's the phrase, under the wings, the Hebrew, let me just look at the Hebrew here. Tachas kenafav. That's tachas kanfei ashchina. Okay, so that's indicative of that, since you were converted. So she's basically saying, "So why are you being so nice to me?" He answers, "Because I've heard of all the good deeds you've done to your mother-in-law. And that you've left your family, you left your people, and you've come to this people. And may Hashem reward you with everything." Okay.
Okay. All right. "May the Lord reward your deeds." Yeah?
She answered,
"You are most kind, my Lord, to comfort me and to speak gently to your maidservant, though I am not so much as one of your maidservants. At mealtime."
All right, so what was she really saying? Again, I'm trying to translate from the archaic English. What did she say back to him?
That she's not that important, that he's treating, she's just...
Right, he's giving her, in a sense, royal treatment, and she's like, I'm not one of your female staff. I mean, I don't know, it's... Right, you're treating me extra special. I don't feel deserving of that, entitled to that. Okay.
"At mealtime, Boaz said to her, 'Come over here and partake of the meal and dip your morsel in the vinegar.' So she sat down beside the reapers. He handed her roasted grain, and she ate her fill and had some left over. When she got up again to glean, Boaz gave orders to his workers, 'You are not only to let her glean among the sheep without interference, but you must also pull some stalks out of the heaps and leave them for her to glean and not scold her.' She gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned. It was about an ephah of barley, and carried it back with her to the town. When her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned, and when she also took out and gave what she had left over after eating her fill, her mother-in-law asked her, 'Where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be he who took such generous notice of you.' So she took her mother-in-law, whom she had worked with, saying, 'The name of the man with whom I work today is Boaz.' Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, 'Blessed be he of the Lord, who has not failed in his kindness to the living or to the dead.' For Naomi explained to her daughter-in-law, 'The man is related to us. He is one of our redeeming kinsmen. Ruth the Moabite said, he even told me, stay close by my workers until all my harvest is finished. And Naomi answered her daughter-in-law Ruth, it is best, daughter, that you go out with his girls and not be annoyed in some other field. So she stayed close to the maidservants of Boaz and gleaned until the barley harvest and the wheat harvest were finished. Then she stayed at home with her mother-in-law.
Okay. So, all right, so basically she was at his fields for months because the barley starts after Pesach, and that's like about April time, and then the wheat thing is till June, July. So it's like April, May, June, July, like 4 months, at least 4 or 5 months of. And meanwhile, she's just, and only that, what did Boaz do? Here's some questions. What did Boaz do to make her even more successful in her gleaning in the fields? What did he tell his staff to do?
Leave extra, right? Like
right. Sure. Drop more stuff on purpose.
Yeah.
Now, why didn't he just say, "Hey, look, you were fantastic to my distant relative Naomi. You know, I'm just going to give you tons of food." Why didn't he do it with a man? I'm just asking another question. Why didn't he just solve the problem this way? He knows that he's indirectly supporting these two people. Why don't you just give him a bunch, you know, give him, you know, pre-mill, why don't you just give him bags of flour? You know what I mean? Just give him the stuff.
So I think it comes to pride, like, you know, like Naomi's pride. Like, she came back and wasn't able, like, she, to your earlier question, like, why, you know, why was she more passive? And I think he sees that, and so he's like, the best way to protect my kinsman is to do it in this more indirect manner.
Good. All right, question four for you guys. This is not such an easy question. How do you reconcile Ruth's active nature with her humility and self-deprecation? Do you understand that question before? Is that question clear?
Not so much. No, I read it. I don't understand.
In other words, on one hand, at the beginning of the chapter, you have Naomi and Ruth are in their house, right? And obviously their food stocks are diminishing. And Naomi doesn't say anything. And Ruth says, would you allow me to go out to glean in the fields to get us food? And then, you know, so she's taking an active, she's taking the bull by her horn. She's like dealing with the situation in a active manner. But then she, when she is going into this environment, you know, she's bowing to the guy. She says, why are you so kind to me to single me out when I'm a foreigner? And you are most kind, my lord, to comfort me and speak gently to your maidservant, though I'm not as much as one of your maids. In other words, how do you explain her activist mentality that she's doing this? And by the way, was Ruth working hard these 5 months?
Probably, yes.
Yeah, because in other words, we had, this goes back, I don't know, like one of the MJE fellowship trips, we did a project with the organization, a very fine organization, is called Leket. So Leket, what Leket is, they do food rescue. In other words, like where caterings and hotels have extra food, they gather it and they distribute it to food pantries throughout of Israel. And they were donated fields. So they get volunteers, like MJEers, to harvest. So we were out there, and you know, it was like August, right? So out in the field, it was hot. I mean, we were schwitzing, and we you know, we gathered about 50 pounds of we picked about 50 pounds of onions in an onion field. So to go gathering wheat, you know, barley, bits and pieces at a time, and then winnow it and, you know, grind it, you know, all these things. It's a very physical labor, and it's not indoors. It's not like us who are in an air-conditioned house and we have two computer screens and we take a little break for some coffee, perhaps a treat. You know what I mean? What's her big break? When is she... What is she offered during her break time? What was the big HR plus that Boaz offered her?
Grains, what is it?
Well, he says, first of all, you can go out and have some of the water which has been drawn in the jars. So you can have water.
That's good.
You know, not exactly.
Does that mean that that's not a common thing, that the workers will not be provided?
Right, well, or maybe the workers would be right, but the people who are coming to glean after them would not.
Yeah.
The other people, the aniyim, the poor, would not. And B, she gets invited for lunch at where all the reapers, in other words, the paid staff, have a communal lunch, right? And she gets to be included, and I guess had some sort of pizza, roasted grape pizza, then you dip it in the vinegar. You know, it's like a Mediterranean diet. Okay. So she's working hard. This woman's, she's schwitzing up a storm. She's an activist person. Yet she seems to be very submissive and passive. I mean, how do you explain that? And if you think about it, you know.
She's not entitled. She's very humble about it. It's not like I did this. Look at the great. How hard I'm working to feed my mother-in-law. She's very humble.
Right. And she says, hey, you know, I left my people to help out my mother-in-law. The least he can do is to, you know, help me out over here. You know what I mean? She's not taking that tack. Now, you might think that might be a strategy. All right, so let's check out. All right, so I put over here, this is if you want to check out the Rashis, they're in English and they're for free, so you can print them out before Yom Tov. Okay. Let's read this one. Let's have David Bavakasha read out the Ralbag, gives a general toelet. At the end of the four chapters of the Megillah, he has, I don't know, like 50 principles or benefits that the Megillah comes to inform. So I just picked number one. I picked one. Just give you a little taste. So read it out. David, your mute is still on.
Sorry about that. The Ralbag's fourth benefit. This story informs us that one who brings themselves close to Hashem, may he be exalted, will be successful in life. You see from the story how Hashem caused Ruth's success to the degree that she married one of the judges. The Ralbag accepts the Midrashic view that Boaz was the judge, Ibsa, and merited that have her descendants become the eternal line of kingship in Israel. The King David emerged from her, who was given the eternal covenant that the kingship will never depart from his lineage.
Okay, so the Ralbag says this story has many pertinent principles, but is that basically this woman, Ruth, basically she went from obscurity to basically being the essentially grandmother or great-grandmother of King David. And he's saying that's an act of providence. So the question, this is a sort of a thought question, a leading question for the entire, read the four chapters of Megillah, question number five. What role did Ruth play in her success? What role did Hashem play in her success? What does that teach us in our own lives? In other words, how do you dissect, you know, she didn't stay in her house and accept the food to come in. She went out to go gleaning. And now she happened upon, quote-unquote, Boaz's fields. And things worked out. And then you'll see later on, and that Naomi says, oh, he's one of our redeemers. By the way, do you know what that was referring to, the redeemer? Do you know what the law of the redeemer is?
Is that the Levirate marriage?
Nope, that's later on.
No.
So here's the deal. Let's say you're, in other words, in the Torah, they had a number of social security nets. One of which, if you're destitute, right, and you sell your ancestral land, your relatives have to buy it back, and you get your field back, and you get the money. So it's a way for you to get sort of like a second chance, and you get dignity, you know what I'm saying? So obviously you don't want to sell your ancestral land, but if you're like really forced to, it gets sold, you get the cash, then your relative should buy it from the other guy and buy it back and redeem it from the buyer and give it back to you. Okay? So Boaz is in the line of the Redeemer. Who was closer? This is a hard fellowship question. Which character was closer in line to be the Redeemer than Boaz? It's later on, chapter 3 and 4. He has a funny name.
Oh, like Plony Almoni or something?
Daphne, that is correct for 500 points and the square. Thank you. Put your hands together for Daphne.
Thank you.
Plony Almoni. So Plony Almoni means basically like John Doe. It's a term of, it means like they hid his identity. Plony Almoni means like, Plony means like some dude. Plony Almoni. So Plony Almoni was supposed to be close, but later on, what was part of the redemption package? If you bought the land back, what did you also get as a responsibility or perk?
A bride.
Yes, and who was that bride?
Naomi.
Ruth. Not Naomi, Ruth. And the idea was to resurrect the family name. Okay, so that's the whole thing. I will also share another thing, which is not, because we're done with this sort of section, because then I want to go to Pirkei Avos for a little bit.
I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Back to that last question you had of, was it divine providence or her own purpose? But like, doesn't it go back to the whole idea of we all have free will? Like, we all have our God has a plan for us in our lives and how our direction is, but it's our free will and how we conduct ourselves to whether how we will get that, achieve that divine, I guess, you know,
divine intervention or divine providence or ashkacha.
Yeah.
Yep.
Was that like part of it? Like,
the question is, there's clearly an interplay here between her actions, or she didn't sit on her tushy. She went to go glean. Now, it's maybe divine intervention that she happened to show up at Boaz's house, show up Boaz's field. And then the story worked its way through. You know what I'm saying? But clearly, it's also part of her. And if she had not been so kind and gracious to her mother-in-law, would all this thing work out? You know what I'm saying? If she remained back in Moab, that wouldn't happen also. She goes from being a Moabite woman to being the great-grandmother of King David. That's a heck of a journey, okay? So the question is, did God just sort of like take her there? So this is, of course, a classic question, and it's not. There's an interplay between the person and God's, you know, involvement, and that question of how that works, and that if you look at the story, if you guys, when you read through the story, that's a question I want you to sort of like you to think about, and again, and in other words, you know, it's like part of the, in other words. The more, you know, on the one hand, there's the more I practice, the luckier I get, right? That's one component. Clearly, that's part of it. If she would have stayed at home, nothing would have happened. And also, in the third chapter, she does a rather gutsy move when she goes into the granary that night and sort of like confronts Boaz in a very nice way to redeem her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's an interplay between God's involvement and her involvement, and that's left purposefully sort of like ambiguous. But the Ralbag says, you know, that, you know, God's involved in her, you know, God's involved in her journey. I'm asking you, how do you dissect those two components, her initiative and providence? So that's something which is clearly, if she does nothing, she would have not got it. So how do you divide the things up? All right, I think now you got like a little bit of a head start on the Megillah. I've given you some questions. I didn't do chapter 3 or 4. You'll do that. So that's something to, that could be easy an hour to think about, read about by yourself. That's good. There's lots of commentary on the Megillah, so you can check that out. So that's good. Now to mix it up, Pirkei Avos. Pirkei Avos is good because it's like short, discreet, neat to eat, treat kind of learning. Whenever you're like tired, you got no juice, it's one sentence, and it's got filled with content, so you can't go wrong with that. So let's take one. All right, Scott, take the first one. 1:6.
Are you going to share?
Oh, I am. Yeah, you won't be able to do that unless I share. Correct. That's hard. Again.
1:6. Joshua Ben Perhiah.
Joshua ben Parachia and Nitai Ha'arbeli, Arbelite. Okay, fine.
Received the oral tradition from them. Joshua ben Parnaya used to say, "Point for thyself a teacher and acquire for thyself a companion and judge all men with the scale weighted in his favor."
All right, so, and this is a case where the Hebrew might be easier than the English. I'm going to go on the Hebrew. So it says, "Aseh lecha rav," literally make for yourself a teacher, "Kneh lecha chaver," which means acquire yourself a friend, or a friend, "and havi dan et kol adam lekav zchus," and judge all people favorably. Okay? So that's that already, without looking at any commentaries, there's a lot of questions here. So throw out some questions off the top.
How are these three things connected?
Good. Excellent question. What else do we got?
How do you acquire all of these things?
Well, it only says you have to acquire a friend. Now, kene, by the way, means acquire, means literally buy yourself a friend. So what's the obvious question?
Why are you buying your friends?
Right. Seems that that seems to be an anathema to our sensibilities. Good. What else?
It's that they can't all be the same person to you. They're all separate.
Well, it says you should judge all people judge favorably. What does that assume? What does the Pirkei Avos assume?
That you're just.
What is the default setting for a person?
Probably negative.
Negative. That assumes that we generally do not judge people favorably. We judge people unfavorably or unfairly, which of course is what obvious questions that bring up.
Why do we do it?
Excellent, Scott. Or why does the Mishnah tell you, oh, by the way, you should try to judge everybody fairly? Implication being is what? Or not? so why do we have such a jaded, cynical perspective? So that is a very good question. That's a sweet question. So I gave you some source material here. There's the Rambam. I put the Rambam down. I put some guiding questions. Okay. So I'm going to let you look at that. Let's get to another one. Here, I'll just go out. Right, so you guys got that one. All right, Adrian, read the next one. This one.
Jemiah.
Yep.
And I can't pronounce that.
Avtalion. By the way, these were two. But they were one of the Bali Hamasora. They were two converts, Shemaiah and Avtalion, who I believe was the teachers of Hillel. Were two converts. So the oral tradition is hinging upon two leaders who were not born Jewish. Just interesting fact. Go on.
Can I read in Hebrew and you translate into English?
Okay, yeah, sure.
Kiblu Mehem.
Yeah, Kiblu Mehem. They received this tradition from them.
Maya Omer Ha-Melacha.
Yeah, so he says, love work. Love work. Go on.
Usna et harbanut.
So ne'eta rabanut means, yeah, hate acting in the position of authority, in order to avoid positions of authority. And lastly,
ve'al, I can't read the vowels on that one.
Okay, yeah, it's a little bit... Good. Al titvadal l'rashut. And don't draw near to the ruling authority. We actually had a class on this once upon a time at some point, whatever. So that's also what, I mean, what are the questions there?
Hate acting the superior. That's a good question.
So he means the better is that acting the not superior, the I would say the role of the superior.
Role of a supervisor.
Right. In other words, taking a role, I'm going to say supervisor, I'm going to say authority. In order to avoid trying to be an authority, you know, being in charge. Avoid it.
Being the president is looked at as the epitome of a person's potential. At least, you know, that's how I...
Well, who in... Here, I'll ask a 500-point question. Who in the Chumash exemplifies that idea of avoiding position of authority? Who dramatized that example in the most dramatic way? In the Chumash. It's a Chumash question.
Is it Moses?
Yeah, how do you... From what example?
From it, he didn't want it. He had... he turned down the position several times.
Yes, he was arguing with God that he's not the right man for the job. According to the Midrash, that discussion lasted a week.
Oh, wow.
In other words, basically, you only take a position of authority or power unless if you don't do it, it won't get done or will done much poorly, much more poorly. Okay, so those are good questions. Also, love work. Why should you love work? Is work sort of like a necessary evil? Why do you have to love work? What's lovable about work?
Well, if you don't love work, then most of your life is going to be miserable.
You could be, you could say, you know, I don't have to love it. I could just do it. You know what I mean? So what is the idea of loving work?
Find something that you actually enjoy doing.
Okay, so I put there the Bartonur, one of the classic commentaries on thing. You will look into that. All right, we got a couple. We have one more. This is probably the most famous Pirkei Avos. So if you don't know this, you don't know Pirkei Avos. So let's have, who has want to read? Let me get Suzanne. This one over here.
I don't see your screen.
And I keep on forgetting that I'm not. Sorry about that. Boom. Good.
The one it says, he also used to say, if
correct.
I'm not myself, who is for me?
Yep.
But if I'm for my own self only, what am I? If not now, when?
Okay, what is that all about? If I'm not for myself, who is for me?
That you have to take care of yourself or your community, because others might not. But you can't just take care of yourself. You have to think broader than that. And that you should, there's no waiting. Like, you should act when, now, kind of, whatever.
If not now, when? Right. Okay, so that is correct. All right.
Sorry.
No problem, correct. Okay, so here's the deal. So that's a very good reading of it, Stephanie. The Rambam has an interesting comment on that. He explores a little bit other dimensions to this. So this is the most famous statement in Pirkei Avos. Hu Ayah Omer, Yimein Ani Limili, Kishani La'atzmi, Ma'ani, Yimalach Shavei Masai. So these are okay. So these are good. This is good. So therefore, like this. This is the game plan here. I suggest printing these out.
I don't know what I keep doing.
Okay, print the stuff out. I think you guys understand the material. I didn't go through all the commentary because we don't have the time. But some of the leading questions. Work on it over Shavuot, and then when we reconvene on Wednesday, next Wednesday, 8 o'clock. We'll go over the material again. I want to hear what you guys had to say. So this way, you guys can have a chance to learn it, and then you can discuss it. And if you guys, whether you bring, if you have other Sfarim, other books, or you print out the other commentaries, Pirkei Avos, there's like 50 commentaries on every Mishnah. And just to, this way, instead of just having, like, random learning, this way you can actually have what to work with. And there's other resources as well. Any questions? Okay, this is outstanding. Okay, so Rabbi Wilds reached out to me today, and he said like this, one of the highlights of the